Case number 25-5152 et al. Coalition for Human Immigrant Rights et al. Appellant versus United States Department of Homeland Security et al. Ms. LaPointe for the appellants, Mr. Venkoswamy for the appellees.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Michelle LaPointe for the plaintiffs' appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. For the past 80 years, the government has decided not to require universal non-citizen registration. And the government has never implemented universal registration combined with a carrier papers requirement. But that all changed on April 11th of this year, when defendants began implementing the interim final rule that plaintiffs challenge in this case. By defendants' own admission, the IFR impacts at a minimum between 2.2 and 3.2 million people who for the first time are subject to registration and who face criminal prosecution if they fail to apply to register.
Let me tamp down a little bit on that last comment about for the first time facing registration, because we have the Alien Registration Act of 1940 requiring all aliens in country over 30 days to register and be fingerprinted. Then we moved to the INA in 1952, and then they added certain things like 14 years and older must apply and carry the papers if you're 18 and older, and then also the misdemeanor. Now, mind you, even though it said all aliens, there were categories in which people filled out the form, and not necessarily everybody had a form that applied to them. And now we're moving to an interim final rule where they would consider it filling the gap. But you start with all were required to do so, even though some didn't have the form. So mind you, you might not have a form to do it, but it at least still said all are required to do it. So that I guess I get to what the intent was.
Right. Your Honor, it is true that the 1940 statute established a requirement to apply for registration for non-citizens. However, the defendants through the decades have narrowed that requirement by not having a form or a method available for a large swath of non-citizens to register. So they made a policy decision to channel non-citizen registration into the immigration process. That means only if you were eligible for and applying for certain immigration relief or benefits did you have a method to register. Therefore, there was no way for large numbers of individuals who were undocumented and had no interaction with the immigration system before and were not eligible for any immigration relief to register.
So you would take the position that if there was not that form or category for them, that even though it said all are required to register, they would not have been in peril of the law.
Right, because there was no means for them to apply for registration. And so there would have been no way for them to be criminally liable for willful failure to register during those years until April 11th of this year. And defendants acknowledge as much in the IFR and the district court recognized as well that this was a big switch in policy, a big switcheroo is what the district court described it as. And that's because, as I said, for these decades, it was only through registration, through immigration processes, that there was an available method of registration.
Something is changing, no question about it, but your opening described what's going on as the creation of a new rule or duty. I read the statute the way Judge Childs does, and if that's true, then it seems like a more fair account of what's happening is the change is that the government is ending a long policy of unlawfully not enforcing a legal duty that on its face covers all aliens.
Judge Katsas, even if that were the case, accepting that premise, the government still needed to go through notice and comment rulemaking in order to implement this IFR. And it did not do so in this case, and that alone dooms the rule. This IFR imposes new substantive burdens that did not exist for the 2.2 to 3.2 million people who previously had no method to apply for registration. It encodes a substantive value judgment about what the government, what DHS in this case thought was important in terms of how to register people, who should be required to register, what type of information should be required of them through the registration process. And it trenches on substantial rights and interests of the individuals who are newly required to register because they previously had no method to do so. So under this court's precedence, that was certainly enough to require notice and comment and to allow the public to weigh in on these important changes before the rule took effect. And that's setting aside the arbitrary and capricious nature of the rule itself. But we think that at a minimum, they had to allow the public to weigh in on these substantial changes.
One point you have, which is a good one, is that the rule does expand the category of information that has to be provided, and that's new. But all of these requirements, the ones in the original statute and the expanded ones in the rule, are in the nature of the government is requiring a private party to give the government information in order to facilitate enforcement of other legal obligations, right? You can only stay in the country for X number of days. You have to comply with your visa, whatever it is. The information, the registration helps enforce that. Why isn't all of that, the new stuff and the old stuff, procedural? Well, so, you know, you had to fill out a form, I assume, for oral argument, and you had to give us a bunch of personal information to facilitate, you know, we can track you. If something happens in the morning, we can call you, whatever it is. It's something of that nature.
Right. So I think it's important to zoom out a little bit and understand that the scope of individuals who are now required to register who previously didn't have a method to do so is so large that it sort of in itself is enough to have required the public to comment. But I think that it's important to know that the government here, the defendants have said that this is a tool of immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. So unlike the folks who previously had a method to register because they came through the visa process and the government ostensibly could have been tracking their compliance with exit requirements under those visas. Now we're talking about an entirely new swath of individuals who entered without inspection. That's pretty explicit.
In order to facilitate enforcement. But right. To me, that tends to cut for procedural. I mean, if you're, say you're on the front end applying for a visa and the government says, here's all the information you have to give us when we consider your visa. That sounds procedural to me.
I think the distinction is that these individuals who are newly impacted by the rule do not have any eligibility, have not applied for any immigration benefits. And so it is solely for the process of facilitating deportation, or as the defendants might say, self-deportation, which I think takes it outside the category of procedural. It is impacting fundamental rights, including members of plaintiffs' associations' First Amendment rights, their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination because they're required to report on any criminal activity, including uncharged criminal activity, without a method to assert their Fifth Amendment rights. And they're experiencing a chilling of speech because of those requirements to report on their activities in the context of what's going on currently with the targeting of individuals, including non-citizens, for First Amendment protected activities.
I'm a little confused. What speech is chilled?
So a number of the plaintiffs' members have stated that they are engaged in political organizing activities on behalf of immigrants' rights causes. And they stated in their declarations that by having to disclose this through the new registration process, they will be chilled and continuing to assert those First Amendment rights, particularly in the context of everything that has been happening in the targeting of non-citizens for their expressive activities. So it's kind of core.
But is that a consequence? Let's divide the form into two things. Most of the information sought on there is already required by statute, including the list of activities. And then there's a couple things, including confess any crime you've ever committed that's been added. Put aside the addition. The requirement to disclose activities already exists in the statute. You do not challenge the constitutionality of the statute.
Correct.
So then how, if it's constitutional for the statute to require it and the form just says, you know, the form said, give us all the information the statute requires. Here's the statute. Would you have the same challenge?
So that's correct that we are not challenging the constitutionality of the statute through this lawsuit. But by using this method of registration, the government made a policy choice to include all of these categories of inquiry.
Hang on a second. I want us to pretend, let's focus only on things that the statute already requires. Now imagine this form said, please give us all the information required by the statute, cites the statute, and then lists the excerpts from the statute, all the things it requires. You would have the exact same obligation to challenge or to list your activities.
Right.
Would you have the same injury? Would you be asserting the same injury then if the form said, just give us what the statute requires?
I think that it is the combination of what the regulation is.
So the answer to my question is no. It's that they ask you for what the statute requires and something else.
Right. So it is by requiring people to report on those activities that the statute does list out, that, as Your Honor says, include all the activities that you've been involved with within the context of what is going on currently with the targeting of non-citizens for their political speech and their First Amendment protected activity.
But then that doesn't, okay, so if the problem isn't really the content of the form, put aside the addition, we're putting those on hold for now. So if we're just focused on what the statute requires, and this will say the form, to the extent it just duplicates what the statute requires, you're saying what makes the rule unlawful is separate enforcement activities that the government is taking?
I think that's part of it because we're not.
Yeah, what else is it? Because I keep trying to understand
right.
Your argument about your combination argument here.
Right.
Not, what else is it on top? I mean, I'm not quite sure how we can look at enforcement activities
right.
as a means of challenging a rule to the extent it duplicates statutory requirements. That's where I'm having trouble.
What it speaks to is the cognizability of a First Amendment harm. So it is requiring them to report on it.
The statute. Okay. So your point, if I understand your point right, and tell me if I don't, it's that not challenging the statute, which says list a lot of things, including all your activities, not challenging that. To the extent the form says the same things as the statute, we're not challenging that. You haven't brought a lawsuit against enforcement activities.
Right.
It's violating the First Amendment or anything. So you're not challenging those. And the rule doesn't say anything about those enforcement activities out there. So what is your challenge? What is the rule doing to harm, say, these speech activities? What is the rule doing? Statute's not doing it. You're not challenging the statute is doing it. You're not challenging the enforcement activities. But the rule's not adding anything at that point.
The other thing that it is doing is it is explicitly a form or a process that will be used for immigration enforcement, as defendants have stated in the rule itself and in comments about the purpose of the rule. So unlike when the statute...
Sorry, explain to me the legal grounds on which we could say it's unlawful for the government to use the information it's lawful for it to collect in an immigration context. It's unlawful then to use it in the immigration context.
Sorry, it's unlawful.
They're collecting this. This is the statute is sort of part of the network of laws that we have regulating the conduct of people who are in the United States who are who are not U.S. citizens or lawful residents, right? So people who are here, whether it's diplomats or people here on tourist visas or everything ranging from the tourist visa to people who've entered without documentation and have remained in the United States without lawful authority, all right? So, and your concern is how they're using the information? That's what you're saying?
We are not challenging how they use it, as Your Honor points out. However, in defining the cognizable harm of having to report on it, it is important to look at the context of what's going on and how they've been using this information.
But I think how you can have a legal harm. It has to be a legally cognizable harm.
Yes.
If you don't challenge any of the things, any of the actions that you say cause that harm. Do you have an example where someone claimed an injury, but everything that caused the injury they agreed was perfectly lawful?
So
not challenged for these purposes. I'm going to equate not challenged as lawful for these purposes.
So I'd have to think a little bit more about the second part of Your Honor's question. But I think if we look at D.C. Circuit precedent on what constitutes chilling, a cognizable chilling effect on First Amendment rights, you know, the standards set out by the Chaplaincy of Full Gospel Churches case, plaintiffs have to establish that they are or will be engaging in constitutionally protected behavior to demonstrate that the government activity would chill this conduct. And multiple plaintiffs in this case have done so. Louisa from Churla, Guvelia from Make the Road, and a lot of other plaintiff members have talked about, they've stated specifically that they are engaging in constitutionally protected activity, core First Amendment political activity and speech activity, and that they are currently experiencing chilling based on the requirement to expose that conduct through this form, which is only for the purpose of immigration.
It's not the question that's chilling them. It's not the question or the obligation to answer the question that's chilling them. It's not the obligation to answer this question on a form that's chilling them. Because you said just the form doing what the statute requires is not the source of chill. It sounds like it's the enforcement activities that are chilling them.
Their position is that it is the obligation to disclose it through this form that, again, has no sort of ameliorative effects, is not simply a an inventory like the statute was first conceived of non-citizens.
Well, but in the statute, this says, I get that people talked about it that way, although sort of questionable. I think that's really what it was doing, was collecting assets, information about assets. This isn't the statute that restricts its use, is it? Is there?
Restricts
the use of the information?
That's correct.
Is there another statute that restricts the use of information?
The information that would be received through the registration process, not that I'm aware of. We do talk about other statutes in the immigration benefits context that have more restrictions on information that protects the confidentiality of information submitted. And that's in, for example, VAWA or the U visa context, but through the registration statute, not that I know of.
Why are we talking about chilling at all in a case where you haven't raised a First Amendment claim? Chill is a theory of a First Amendment harm. Here, your primary contention is an APA question about whether this change is substantive or procedural. And why is chilling relevant to that?
Your Honor, it's correct that we have not brought a freestanding First Amendment claim in this case. We do talk about in our complaint the failure to consider First Amendment and Fifth Amendment issues as part of the arbitrary and capricious challenge in the APA. And there are other cases outside of the circuit that have considered in the irreparable harm context constitutional injuries. For example, the Mock v. Garland case from the Northern District of Texas, the Alabama versus U.S. Secretary of Education case from the 11th Circuit. These are cases where constitutional harms were considered as part of the APA analysis, and we think that it is appropriate to do so here. There's certainly no prohibition on doing so. Defendants have not cited any cases where this is not permitted. And again, we just think in addition to the notice and comment issue, it goes to the arbitrary and capricious nature of this. So
I get you have plausible theories for folding it into arbitrary and capricious and maybe irreparable harm. Just on the notice and comment, are you contending that the separate enforcement activity could make what would otherwise be a procedural requirement into a substantive one? Or you're just talking about chill for those other issues?
I think it goes to the notice and comment claim as well in the sense of making a substantive value judgment about the purpose of the registration system and the criteria for setting it up, and the fact that it trenches on individuals' First and Fifth Amendment rights and interests, which is part of the test in the circuit about whether it is procedural or legislative rule, not just rights, but also interests. So it goes to both the notice and comment claim and the arbitrary and capricious claim. I think we can, what, I understand.
Oh, what's the extent of the post-promulgation comments that are being offered here? Do you not feel like that's effective? Because we are in an interim rule as opposed to a final rule.
Right. So the government didn't give people the public the ability to comment, of course, before the rule went into effect. And so to the extent that comments were submitted, which are not part of the record here because it was a pre-enforcement challenge, none of those comments would have been considered as part of the agency's rulemaking. And they have not subsequently modified the interim rule in any way. So it is as promulgated in the Federal Register is the language that ended up being the rule here.
You've also asserted that the IFR, not the IMA, actually exposes the non-citizens to the criminal liability, but the criminal liability was in the IMA.
That's correct, but it goes back to the lack of a means to it, and the statute says apply for registration, which I think is important here.
And be fingerprinted.
Correct. That is correct, Your Honor. But one cannot apply for registration if the government does not provide a means for doing so. And the CFR, 8 CFR 264.1 talks about prescribed forms that count as registration documents or evidence of registration. So without a prescribed form to do so, these millions of people previously did not have a method to register, wouldn't have been exposed
to criminal. Give me a sense of what the commentary for notice and comment would be. In other words, as I started out in this hearing about that you had the registration requirements way back from the FIRST Act and then superseded by the INA, and then we got executive order, and then we now have this interim rule. So the opportunity or the principle to register has always been out there. So if you go to notice and comment, I don't see the policy of wanting that requirement to change. But what would your commentary be about it? Because it sounds to me like you're more focusing on, I'm worried about these 2.2 or 2.3 million somehow getting caught up into all of this and potentially there being enforcement against them. And that sounds like an educational campaign, you know, from one standpoint of, yes, the rule goes into effect, but we don't implement it we don't implement it or make it be really effective for 4 months or so that there can be the widespread campaign by groups such as yours and others. And so what would notice and comment for you achieve?
Your Honor, it would achieve the purpose of notice and comment rulemaking under the APA, which is to allow the public to have offered their input on this policy choice here. I think this goes more to the arbitrary and capricious argument, but it's clear under this circuit's precedent that a change in policy as fundamental as the one at issue here requires the agency to acknowledge that the previous policy existed and they made a choice to change it. And then, of course, to engage in reasoned decision-making to underlie the new rule. We can look at the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign case. Physicians for Social Responsibility make clear that whether it's a formal policy or an informal policy, at a minimum, the agency had to acknowledge the immense change that it was undertaking here and provide a reasoned explanation for doing so. And here, the agency just completely glosses over that requirement. And again, just sort of goes back to the existence of the statute to justify this change. But that does not pass muster under this court's arbitrary and capricious precedents.
On the question, on the line between substance and procedure, it's not the clearest line ever, but we have some cases suggesting that one consideration, at least in close cases, the question might turn on the extent of the burden. Government cites this JEM broadcasting case. It's an issue of degree. Are the burdens so grave as to warrant notice and comment rulemaking? Do you agree with that formulation?
I agree that is part of the test, certainly. But if you look at the cases where this court found that a rule was procedural, you'll find that it really, they hew a lot closer to this idea of it only regulates the manner in which an individual presents himself to the agency, certain things like deadlines to file
I'm going to ask you to assume two things that you disagree with, but stay with me. Okay. Suppose I think that the kind of duty here, providing information to the government that helps the government enforce, is in the gray area. It's maybe substantive, maybe procedural. It's an edge case. And put aside the question of harms from enforcement. So I'm thinking about, is this a substantial, serious, heavy burden, or is this kind of a record-keeping thing? And just looking at the form, I mean, how long do you think it would take for an average alien to fill out this form? Name, address. And the hardest part of this would seem to be police and criminal record, and that's directly out of the statute. And the rest of it seems pretty pro forma.
So a few things to consider there. First, as plaintiffs have pointed out, this is an online-only form available only in English, and that in itself makes it inaccessible to a large number of people who can't access the internet or speak English. In addition, though, looking at the burden on individuals to actually fill it out, there is, and I don't have it at my fingertips, but I believe it's about an hour that the government estimates in the IFR that it would take them, in addition to the time to go provide biometrics. And the lost wages, of course, that would be entailed with going through this process. So that is certainly part of it. But I think if we're looking at the other cases where this court found that a rule was procedural, they just are very far from this IFR in the sense that they actually talk to issues of agency efficiency. I don't hear the government saying here that, yes, they talk about law enforcement objectives and improving law enforcement outcomes, but it's unclear to me how the requirement of submission of a new form, an entirely new process for U.S. citizenship and immigration services to undergo and to process is somehow increasing agency efficiency. That's actually a new burden for the government in addition to the non-citizen. And that part is a bit unclear to me as well. And so it's just really, I understand the procedural and legislative line is sometimes a bit, there are close calls. This is a bit blurry, but in this case, I think it is so far from the procedural side of the line that the agency absolutely had to allow the public to comment.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question about irreparable harm? Are you aware of any case where we have issued or we have stayed or asked public district court they should have stayed, they erred in not staying or enjoining based just on a notice and comment violation?
I'm sorry, was your Honor's question whether a district court has...
Whether this court has... Is there any precedent from this court or another appeals court addressing whether a notice and comment violation, put aside your arbitrary and capricious challenge. I don't forget that you have that. I got that. But for your notice and comment argument, if that alone inflicts irreparable harm that would support a preliminary injunction for stay?
Your Honor, I'm looking back at the notes. I don't think we had an example in the preliminary injunction or 705 stay context, although I'd have to confirm that. Of course, I'm thinking about Mendoza versus Perez, but that was not a preliminary posture.
Sure. But I mean, final relief could happen there. I'm just talking about right. Where you really have to have the irreparable harm. And I'm just wondering how notice and comment violations inflict irreparable harm.
I believe that we did not cite a case precisely in that posture, but I'm going to confirm
certainly
that.
Certainly for arbitrary and capricious it happens, but yes.
Right.
Okay. And then I get, as the district court judge said here, and Judge Katz noted that, this is a big change because there just hadn't been a registration opportunity until this form, or for the most part hadn't been unless you were going through the immigration process. If when the statute was first enacted, this rule had been adopted, so you don't have that time gap, you don't have that lapsed enforcement and then now new enforcement, well, would you have been able to challenge it then? And put aside again the provisions that go beyond what the statute requires.
I think it would have been a much closer call. I think it's
fact. Would have been the challenge?
It would have depended on what the agency decided to put in the registration form and requirements.
Let's assume, again, for purposes of my question, okay, that it's only things that are listed in the statute. It's this form, but only things listed in the statute.
In that case, it may not have been, we may not have been able to challenge the initial rule in Your Honor's formulation that emerged from the statute if it was precisely on all fours with what is in the statute. I think we'd still want to look at, the test for procedural versus legislative rule. And in that case, I think there's a possibility that we would have still been able to challenge the rule as requiring notice and comment rulemaking. And of course, there may have been other arbitrary and capricious, et cetera, but it would have been a lot closer call.
Would you have had irreparable injuries from the rule? Assuming you were bringing notice and comment and arbitrary and capricious, not quite sure what it would be. But again, I get here there are things that go beyond the statute, and that's an important part of your arguments, but if we don't, as to the things that are covered by the statute.
I think that also would have been a lot more difficult. Given the passage of time and the decision of the agency in this case to abandon a prior policy, that is part of the reason we're arguing.
Okay, I get that can be grounds for APA challenge. So what I'm struggling with is how, again, putting aside the questions that go beyond the statute, just the all crimes thing is big. If we take that off the table, I'm struggling to see what the irreparable harm would have been. Why it changes based just on this time lapse. Do you have a reasonable reliance interest in a standing statutory obligation not being enforced or implemented? That's just the difficulty of this case.
Yeah.
And the statute's been there a long time, as Judge Childs pointed out.
Right. I think that's why we have to go back to the context of the way that the obligation has evolved over the years. And that ends up feeding into the notice and comment claim in addition to the arbitrary and capricious claim. And it speaks to irreparable injury because for the first time and suddenly a new obligation is being imposed on these millions of individuals. And I think that is an important aspect that would not necessarily have arisen had they implemented interim final rule right after the passage of the statute itself.
Just on the notice and comment portion, how do you feel that this does not fit the procedure exception to notice and comment when it's like the agency organization procedure or practice in that regard?
I think, Your Honor, it's because of the things we've been discussing that this is imposing substantive burdens that did not prior to the IFR exist. In code substantive values in terms of what the agency is seeking and why they decided to implement it at this point and so suddenly, and the substantial private rights or interests. I also wanted to point out that the large swath of individuals that are impacted here plays into the determination of it being a legislative and not a procedural rule as well. I think under this court's precedence, when we're talking about the impact on, for example, thousands of employers that this court talked about in Chamber of Commerce versus U.S. Department of Labor, 174 F3rd 206, we're talking about such a substantial public impact that notice that it takes it over the line from procedural to legislative.
You mentioned that they should mention why they entered this rule and the impact and why now. Why is all that important? Again, with the overarching that this is not a new law, so to speak, in terms of just non-citizens registering.
Your Honor, that speaks to the arbitrary and capricious analysis and the requirement therein that the agency has to acknowledge the change and not sort of gloss over it the way they've done with this IFR and to offer a reasoned explanation for it. Just sort of fundamental principle.
And you don't see that as gap filling, meaning that these people now have a form that didn't otherwise fit into these other categories.
Right. We think it absolutely required them to go through the analysis under State Farm to consider the alternatives, to take into consideration the costs and the benefits under Michigan versus EPA, and their failure to do so here rendered it arbitrary and capricious.
And are you aware of any of your clients actually having filled out the form and experienced any repercussions?
We do not have any information about that. Currently, it's not in the record. This, of course, was a pre-enforcement challenge. So the obligation to fill out the form had not arisen by the time the plaintiffs requested preliminary relief in this case.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll give you your time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Karthik Venkaswamy on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, I would like to just stress that, as we pointed out in our brief, the most important thing here is standard of review. And as under this Court's precedent, the issue is it's an abuse of discretion review over the District Court's decision ultimately to find no irreparable harm. And as we have argued in our brief, and as I'll continue to argue here, the District Court was correct in finding that there is no irreparable harm. In fact, as Your Honors have discussed previously with my colleague just now, it seems that they have essentially conceded that any true harms in this case arise out of the enforcement or the extraneous factors, the statute, the enforcement, all of those things are the harms from which they're actually complaining and the harms of which they're actually saying are irreparable. As Judge Miller, as you asked, there is no harm arising from the rule itself, and they have not been able to point to any harm.
No. They answered that in response to my questions that assume the form only duplicates the questions of the statute. But this form goes beyond the questions in the statute.
Your Honor,
requiring people to report any crime ever committed anywhere in the world, even if they weren't arrested or prosecuted or convicted. Nothing in the statute requires that much, does it?
Your Honor, respectfully, under 8 U.S.C. section 1304(5), the statute specifically both authorizes and directs the secretary to ask four broad questions and such additional matters as may be prescribed. The statute.
Sure, but the statute itself didn't make the judgment. I mean, those additional matters have to be within reasonable bounds under the APA and constitutional bounds. And so requiring everybody on pain of prosecution and deportation to confess to the government every crime they've ever committed.
Your Honor is correct that the specific requirement that they confess to other crimes outside of this jurisdiction or not from which they're arrested is not specifically enumerated in the statute.
Right, that's the point.
But the statute does encompass asking for the police and criminal record of the individual.
I get that. But all crimes never known by police, not in any criminal record, is a very different inquiry.
Your Honor, respectfully, it's not that
crimes
different.
Committed outside United States jurisdiction?
Your Honor, respectfully, it's just an expansion of what's already in the statute and falls under both the catch-all and the police criminal record sections.
No, it is not. It is not. If I said, tell me every crime you have ever committed in your life. Now, I assume if I ask you if you have a criminal record, the answer is going to be no, because you're a member of the bar. And maybe even also for police record, I'm assuming these things, right? But if I say, have you ever committed any crime, recognizing that speeding on the George Washington Parkway or the Baltimore Washington Parkway is a crime, not a civil infraction. Littering in a national park is a crime. You know, that's asking you to confess to things that no governmental authority is aware of. That is a big step. And it's also a big step closer to the Fifth Amendment than disclosing police and criminal records, which are matters of public record.
Your Honor, I agree with you that that would be asking the court, asking in this hypothetical me to confess, although I do believe that I do believe the bar application actually does ask you.
I do take the Fifth on the parkway sometimes.
No, I do actually believe the bar applications ask you that. They ask you to confess anything that you've ever done, regardless of whether you've been convicted of it. I think that's actually a question, and it is a procedural question. Again, going to the collection of information that then might be used in enforcement. But even agreeing with Your Honor that specific question.
I was just clarifying what her answer was, though. It wasn't.
Absolutely.
They definitely challenged the.
And even conceding that point, though, the harm still comes from enforcement of the statute. The harm still arises out of the statute directly, not out of the rule and not out of the form. The form is not causing any harm here. The rule is not causing any harm. And so the district court's decision.
It's a little hard to separate the confess everything you've ever done, and now we're going to use the information on that form to go after you either for deportation or criminal prosecution or both.
Your Honor, if they had made that argument in either this court or the court below, if they had pled that there was any reasonable or imminent danger of that specific question being the cause, but that's not what they're saying.
They definitely challenged that's the basis for their Fifth Amendment irreparable harm claim.
Your Honor, for the Fifth Amendment claim, but as Judge Katz has pointed out, they haven't actually made a constitutional claim.
No, but they said an APA claim includes contrary to law. That would include unconstitutional actions, would it not?
It would, Your Honor, but a Fifth Amendment claim isn't only.
It might even be arbitrary and capricious to ask people for information. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. I'm not saying that itself would actually violate the Fifth Amendment, but it rubs awful a lot closer than anything in the statute does. And so, you know, just to be clear where we are on this, but they can bring an APA challenge that says this is contrary to law. They could say constitutional avoidance through the statute is not including that in the authority. They can do that.
Sure, they can bring the challenge, but I think the crux of the assessment at this point is the fact that this is a preliminary injunction that's up on appeal and not a 705. This is not a final rule. This is not a 705 challenge. This is a preliminary injunction challenge that was denied by the district court, and the district court determined, weighing law and fact, that there was no irreparable harm in this case, and there's no abuse of discretion in that finding. But even
I just have one more procedural. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
A procedural question that I'm really kind of confused about: what exactly is before us? So, what's certainly before us is the district court's initial denial of preliminary injunction on the grounds of lack of standing. That's before us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then the district court, on their application for injunction pending appeal, said, oh, no, not a standing problem, but an irreparable harm problem. in evaluating under an abuse of discretion the denial of the preliminary injunction, can we consider the district court's analysis of irreparable harm, which was only on a injunction pending appeal, not the, on a separate request for relief from the parties?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with you that there is some confusion given the fact that there are three separate appeals in this case. But ultimately, under the case law, this court can consider any of the rulings from the court below and all of the issues that are in the record. And so this court can and should consider sort of both of the district court's decisions. And I think both parties...
Is that true for preliminary injunction discretion, which, as you said, is abuse of discretion analysis, that we can consider... If the only viable notice of appeal before us, which I thought was your argument, was the first notice of appeal, where the district court, at that record, that preliminary injunction record coming up to us doesn't include the irreparable harm analysis, we have to bring a different record up to us, a later record up to us, to consider the district court's analysis of irreparable harm.
In this case, no, Your Honor. If all of the procedural rules have been followed appropriately, the second notice of appeal would not have been a second notice of appeal. It would have been part of the record in this court, because what should have happened is they should have, under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 8, they should have then filed a motion for a stay in the district court pending this court's determination, instead of being a second appeal. And so in that motion, that would have rolled up everything, including the district court's analysis. I'm going to say the second go-round, for just as a shorthand, but ultimately, all of the facts are in the record before this court. I mean, this court, I believe, should send a message that this sort of gamesmanship and multiple appeal filing is problematic.
I don't think
problematic,
it's gamesmanship. But... to be clear, let's not. There's no reason to make an accusation like that. It seems to me it was just a very confusing procedural posture, and they're perhaps trying to protect their rights and to get all these things in before, you know, up before us. And so they appealed what they could appeal. They didn't know the district court was going to switch horses.
I stand correct, and I certainly didn't mean to accuse him of anything, Your Honor. More so, just to clean up the record and to make it clear, I believe this all should have been one appeal, but it
all... But if it had been an appeal before the district court rules on irreparable harm, then it's not before us? Or is it?
Because...
What can we consider that postdates the preliminary injunction record?
Your Honor, if this had been sort of by the book, this would have been up on a... Federal Appellate Procedure 8 motion. And
they did file Rule 8 motions, and those have already been ruled on by this court. But I don't know that a Rule 8 motion allows... Can we rely on things told to us for the first time in a Rule 8 motion to evaluate the district court's exercise of discretion on the record that was before the district court at the time the district court ruled? That would seem almost unfair to district courts.
I believe you can, Your Honor, because again, it's all part of the record before this court, and this court has the discretion to consider anything that was properly presented to the district court in making its determination. But ultimately, even if we go back, Your Honor, as I was about to say, we should first take a look at the standing argument, and the district court, as a matter of law, was incorrect in this instance in finding that the plaintiffs had established standing in its second order, and the district court was not correct in its first finding. The plaintiffs did not have standing in this case. The plaintiff associations don't have standing because none of the members have standing. And none of the members have standing because they have not pled a cognizable Article III injury under the TransUnion line of cases.
What? Sorry, why not? They are, some of the members are aliens unlawfully present in the U.S. They're the regulated, directly regulated parties.
Your Honor, they're not directly regulated parties because the harm in this case, as the TransUnion court pointed out, the harm has to be analogous to a common law or otherwise traditional harm. And in this case, the harm, if any, is the harm
order,
of being prosecuted by another statute.
I mean, TransUnion says that on when there's an intangible injury that might or might not be concrete for standing purposes. This may be insubstantial in the sense you can fill out the form in an hour, but it's very concrete. I mean, there are people who have to fill this thing out and they have to disclose more information than others, you know, than the statute requires. That seems concrete to me.
Your Honor, going back to the TransUnion and finding an analogy there, there were two separate sets of plaintiffs in the TransUnion case. One set who definitely had their privacy information released from the government to a third party, and they had a cognizable, tangible harm there versus the second group who did not have their information released and, in fact, had just given their information to the, you know, the original recording body. And they did not have standing because there was no harm in that case to the intangible, non-concrete, non-analogous harm of simply maybe your information is out there or maybe it's not. We don't know. In this case, the only requirement that's new is, okay, it's actually not even a new requirement. The only thing that's changed is there's now one more form in the menu of forms by which an alien can register with the government. There were,
what
I believe,
they doing before?
Say that again.
I mean, when you had the old laws there and you don't fit into a particular category and you're otherwise not in the immigration line, you know, with the courts, et cetera, what did that group of people do before in terms of offer enforcement by the government?
Your Honor, up until the rule was passed and the new form was created, that group of individuals, they had a duty to register, but they had no ability to register. And so they were essentially flying under the radar. So what's happening in this case is the government has taken section.
The government have taken the position that if you caught somebody who didn't fit into one of those categories, you still say they have the duty, but then there's no enforcement because they don't have the ability to register because it wasn't a form that they need to fill out. So the government would have taken that position.
That's exactly right. And under Section 1306, the criminal penalties attached to the willful failure to register. And there can't be a willful failure to register if there's no method by which to register. But
Okay. No, I was just going to next move on to the post-promulgation comments. Is there an intention of a final rule?
Your Honor, I can't speak to that. I'm not entirely sure at this point because we're up before the court on a pre-enforcement preliminary injunction challenge. The record here is only really what we're looking at.
What's the purpose of the post comments?
Your Honor, I believe in the Federal Register, the post comments include the requirement to qualify under the Paperwork Reduction Act and the necessity to submit data to the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, regarding the costs of filling out the form and, you know, sort of the paperwork reduction aspects of the rule, not necessarily the creation of the form, because under 8 U.S.C. Section 1304, the creation of the form is essentially a mandatory requirement imposed upon the government. The secretary is authorized and directed to prepare forms for registration.
In light of, you know, several things going on with respect to immigration, opposing counsel mentioned online form, English only. How do we expect to get all this information out to people for them to actually comply?
Your Honor, I agree with you that the fact that it's an online only form and it's English only, I know that my colleague on the other side has made a great point about that, but there are a number of forms that the U.S. government provides that are online only and English only. English is the language of the United States government at this point, and it's how all of our forms are created. And
Immigration forms?
Your Honor, I
can't
speak.
English only?
I don't know if they're all English only. I do know that not every language is represented. I know there are several.
That's not what I asked.
I don't know.
I asked, are they English only?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, then I don't understand your point about we have lots of forms that are in English only. You're dealing with, these are forms regulating a community where, by definition, a significant percentage will come in where English, at best, is not their native language, and they may not speak it at all. And I think it's been long recognized and in the government's interest to make immigration forms available in at least the primary languages of those who tend to enter the United States.
Absolutely.
Has that changed?
No, Your Honor. And no. It certainly may be the case that as this is only an interim rule, it may very well be the case that as this progresses, the government will provide translations and provide other opportunities. And I would also like to stress, Your Honor, that in this hypothetical.
But you just said, that's why I'm curious. You don't have information for us just to ask your client about what the status of this rule is, because if you're in the process of saying, whoops, we didn't mean English only here. Whoops, we meant the criminal content of the disclosure of criminal activities to be identical to that in the statute, that lets us know what we have to decide and not decide here. So surely you can tell us, or the client, your agency, be willing to update us on the status of this rule.
Your Honor, certainly to the extent that it makes a difference in this court's determination, I'm happy to go back and ask my client that. And I apologize if I misspoke, indicating that there was a mistake in either going beyond the the context of the statute or in saying this is English only. The bigger issue, Your Honor, is that the creation of this form and the dissemination of that form as a method of complying with the INA and the statutes, ultimately that in and of itself is not a harm, and that in and of itself does not provide standing to the plaintiffs.
Why isn't it a harm? If police arrest somebody and that person, they know that person until doesn't understand English, and they give them Miranda warnings in English only, would that be considered consistent with the Miranda requirement?
Your Honor, No.
They would not have been Mirandized.
Okay.
That's why police have it in different languages. And now you're going to say we're going to impose an obligation on penalty of criminal prosecution for you to fill out information you can't read and you can't understand.
Your Honor, under this hypothetical.
And you're going to tell me that's not a harm?
Your Honor, under this hypothetical, using the Miranda analysis, I don't know this for a fact, Your Honor. I'm not a criminal attorney, but under that same analysis, they would not have willfully failed to register under 1306 because they don't, as you said, they can't understand the form.
The government's position is if they can't read the form, they don't have to register?
Your Honor, this is a question I haven't.
You just said that to me.
I'm saying in this hypothetical.
It wouldn't be willful.
Under this hypothetical, under the Miranda analysis.
Right. So I'm asking, so it's the same. You just said it wouldn't be willful. There's no willfulness for Miranda, so I assumed you were transitioning to the willful requirement in the statute.
I believe that if there was an...
So you're not going to prosecute anybody who doesn't fill out this form because it's in English and they don't speak or understand English?
It's not that, Your Honor. I think that the prosecution, again, is in a different statutory section than the requirement that the secretary...
I don't know what that's got to do with anything. If they're irreparably injured if they face... prosecution. That's a risk. People want to comply with the law. People don't want to be prosecuted. And they're left here in this rock hard place of, I can't understand this form. I don't know what to do with it, but I'm told I have to do this. And you just said, well, it won't be a problem because clearly it won't be willful noncompliance if they can't understand the form, which is a very sensible position for the government to take. I'm just making sure I understand it right.
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to speak to whether or not that is, in fact, the position that the government would take in enforcement past this point. But I do believe that the underlying issue is whether or not this rule, as a procedural rule, is somehow converted to a substantive rule merely because of the menu of language options. Presumably, any number of language options will be insufficient because there are always
more. It seems to me quite a conscious decision in the immigration context, whereby practice, tradition, just realistic enforcement, the government uses multiple languages, including predominant languages. And then this rule comes along and says, no, in the immigration context, where we are seeking information from people where we can probably take judicial notice of the fact that a large percentage will not speak English or will not speak it fluently enough to maybe understand exactly what they're being asked on a form, and the government has chosen to do it in English only, unlike many, many, if not all other immigration forms. And they're doing it when they know the population will be subject to deportation or criminal prosecution if they don't fill it out. And you want to tell me that putting people in that bind is just routine paperwork obligation as opposed to a substantive judgment by the government that increases the risk of harm to people in their efforts to comply?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that that is the case. I'm simply saying that the fact that the form is English only does
not... What about it isn't the case? I just described to you the case. I described to you factually what has happened here. What about my description was inaccurate? I mean, assume this was an intentional decision. It's a rule. I mean, you intend what you say in your rules.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I'm happy to provide more information about when and if additional translations are forthcoming. But the fact that the initial version of the form in the interim final rule happens to be English only does not, in and of itself, make this into a substantive value judgment or encoding anything that entrenches on rights. It's a form that they're required to create. They're directed to create under Section 1304 to make sure that all aliens have the ability to register, as they are required to do, the duty to register.
The IRS said, we're going to issue new tax codes. They're new tax forms. They're just forms for everyone to fill out for their taxes. We're not creating tax obligations. It's just new forms. In ancient biblical Greek. Notice and comment needed?
That's a good question, Your Honor. No, because it's a procedural
That's
form.
That's fantastic. Wow. Wow. We can all be criminally prosecuted for not filing our taxes unless we can find the five people in the United States who know how to speak ancient biblical Greek. And that's not a change in people's obligations. They're going to have to expend effort and face consequences.
Your Honor, the hypothetical and the points you're making, I think, are important points to consider. But if we step back and look at the underlying issue in this case, is the creation of the 12th form in the menu of forms that an alien can use to register with the government, is the creation of the 12th one in that list.
This is the one universal one for people who aren't seeking those other forms. It's not that they can't fill out those other forms. They can't fill out the visa form if they've been here already for a year. They can't, if they're not seeking asylum, they can't fill out that form. This is the only form that applies to millions and millions of people who haven't had a form for a long time.
That's exactly right. You know, there are millions of people that have been unable to comply with the statutory duty to apply for registration. And the government is taking steps to fill the gap, as Judge Childs pointed out, to fill the gap between Section 1304 and the duty to create forms to register, and Section 1302, the duty to register. There has been space in that arena up until this rule was created, and the government has taken steps to close the daylight there and make sure that there's a one-to-one connection between its duty to create forms to enable everyone to register and the individual's duty to register.
Did all the other forms that were identified with respect to the INA go through the notice and comment period?
Your Honor, as we pointed out in our brief, several of them do not. At least seven instances did not go through the notice and comment because they were merely procedural rules, as this one is. And going back to, I believe it was Judge Katsas, your question about, you know, the impact on this. This court has previously held in the EPIC case, in the TSA EPIC case, that substantive impact, the fact that it's impacting a million people, does not make it automatically a substantive rule. What matters is whether it changes the rights of the individual with respect to the agency. And the rights in this
case, and interests, rights or interests.
Sorry, yes, Your Honor, rights or interests. And the rights and interests of the individuals in this case are set forth in statute and have been for 80 years. They have a duty, the rights and interests of the individual is to register, sorry, to apply for registration. That's what the duty is. That has been the substantive right and interest for over 80 years. Nothing in this rule changes that.
Does the government intend to promulgate a final rule?
Your Honor, I assume so, based on the text of the Federal Register and the fact that they are.
Do we know anything about where that stands?
I do not, Your Honor.
Well, I guess maybe that moots out my next question, which was going to be, would this case moot out upon promulgation of a final rule?
It would, at this point, if nothing changed, Your Honor, and the preliminary injunction remains denied, and the district court's subsequent ruling to stay the district court matter pending this court's determination, if nothing else changed, and there was a final rule, Your Honor, that might boot this out. But given that we're in a pre-enforcement preliminary injunction context, I couldn't say for certain.
One other question from me. The way this works, this new form was added to a list of forms in the regulation that will satisfy the general statutory obligation to register. Do these other forms include all of the questions on the newly promulgated one?
To the best of my knowledge, Your Honor, they all include the first four questions that are set forth in 1304. And then I think there are variations between them based upon the intent of each of the form. Like I suspect.
This, because this form has a fair amount of content that falls within the statutorily required questions, but it also has a fair amount of new content that is perfectly fine under sub 5 of the statute, but is new content.
Your Honor, again, I agree that there are some questions on this form that have not been included in previous forms, but there are other instances, as I said, we point out in our brief, there are at least 7 other instances where the agencies have created new forms under the procedural rule. And those have different questions. The crewman's landing permit forms has different questions than the visa application form, because the purpose of the forms and the information sought is different. And there are going to be some section, subsection 5 variations there.
And as to the new material, your position is some combination of this is all procedural, like providing information to the government to facilitate enforcement of other obligations and or not that burdensome.
Yes, Your Honor. It's procedural or ministerial almost based on the specific language of 1304. It also falls under this court's precedent under interpretive rules, as in the U.S. Telecom case where...
Well, it can't be interpretive because you just told me there's new content being required.
Sorry, Your Honor, but in the Telecom case, this court sort of said, if it's just crisply delineating the lines, and that's sort of what's happening here.
Extent of burden helps resolve the edge cases is the point.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right.
Any questions?
Your Honors, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your assistance. Okay, Ms. LaPointe, have you asked for 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Just wanted to start talking about the harm issues that came up in my colleague's section. We wanted to emphasize that the harm is not solely from the constitutional, the injury to constitutional rights that we have talked about extensively, and I understand Your Honors have some questions about. We're also talking about the harm to members, such as the UFW members who submitted declarations in this case, that they simply cannot access these forms because they don't have smartphones or access to the internet and do not speak English and therefore cannot fill out the forms and go through the registration process, placing them at direct risk of prosecution under the government scheme. We do not concede that the harm only arises, as my colleague on the other side said, from extraneous factors such as increased immigration enforcement. There are several other harms that we've identified in our papers. Second, as to the wide swath of information that the IFR is requiring beyond that which is required by the statute, as we have said previously, that implicates the need for notice and comment because it reflects a substantive value judgment that the agency is making here about the content of what to include here. But it also speaks to the arbitrary and capricious nature of this rule. And the government's choice to make it only an English form, an online-only form, and to require the disclosure of all this other information. So it goes to both aspects of the APA claim. The other rules that didn't go through notice and comment that my colleague mentioned, as we point out in our reply brief, those are instances where the government was narrowing the burden on individuals, taking off certain requirements for fingerprinting and so forth. When they did add additional burdens, those rules did go through notice and comment rulemaking. Most famously and recently in the NSEERS program after 9/11, that required members of certain nationalities and predominantly Muslim countries to register with the government, which was subsequently rescinded. Both went through the imposition of the requirements, went through notice and comment rulemaking. Now, whether or not the government is ultimately going to promulgate a final rule, the reality is that they are prosecuting people now for failure to register, and that's all that needs to be known about the government's intentions here. In addition, we did ask for a 705 stay in addition to a preliminary injunction. I just wanted to clarify that. And my colleague's comment about the other forms not requiring all this information, just look at one of the pieces of registration evidence, which is the notice to appear in immigration court. That is a form that the government itself issues and does not require disclosure of all this other additional information. And with that, I see my time is...
Do you know if most, not all other immigration forms are in multiple languages?
Your Honor, I believe that some are, but not all of them. Yeah. But those would be for immigration benefits rather than the imposition of criminal and civil liability, as this form is here, which we believe speaks to the need to have it accessible in multiple languages.
Mm-hmm. As to the issue about the criminal record, in the INS under 8 U.S.C. 1304A-4, it does state that you have to indicate your police and criminal record, if any, of such alien. So by that being vague, you know, with respect to police or criminal record, that could include arrests. And it also doesn't limit itself to the United States. So do you think that's different than what's on this form?
We do, in the sense that the new form requires any potential crime that was committed anywhere in the world that wasn't necessarily charged in any manner or prosecuted, and therefore it goes far beyond what's required by the statute. Your Honor, with that, we would respectfully request that the district court's order be reversed and a 705 stay or preliminary injunction entered.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Venkateswamy, I think it would be helpful to the court if you could contact your client and give us an update on the status, if any, of the rule, with the potential of whether a final rule is expected or comments are expected.
That's right. Just a status report on the current status.
And future plans. Yes, just to keep us updated. Thank you. All right. With that, the case is submitted. Thank you to both counsel.